Welcome to Finding Proof, where we discuss all things early stage VC.
We're your hosts, Thanasis and Jenny of the Proof Fund, and our goal is to get to know the best seed and early stage VCs out there.
In this episode, we spend some time getting to know Hadley Harris, who is a founding general partner of ENIAC Ventures, a 10-year-old venture capital firm based out of New York City that invests in seed stage opportunities across the U.S. Hadley, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate your time. I wanted to start off with asking you to tell us about ENIAC, because you guys recently announced the formation of your fifth fund.
Yeah, sure. And thanks for having me on the show. So we started ENIAC about 11 years ago, but actually my three partners and I have known each other for now 25 years. We all were engineering students together at the engineering school at University of Pennsylvania way back in the late 90s, all graduated in 99. And kind of coincidentally, all got into tech and into startups. And independently, between the four of us, started or helped grow 10 venture-backed businesses and stayed friends during that time, didn't work together directly. And then around 12 years ago, started thinking about what we're going to do next. We're considering a bunch of different options and then decided to raise a seed fund back when people didn't really even call it seed funds. It was kind of more angel funders. People just started using the term seed around when we were starting out.
Yep.
Our first fund was tiny, $1.6 million, our own savings and friends and family money. And then it kind of progressed ever since. And as you mentioned, just recently announced our fifth fund, which is $125 million.
And so what was the genesis of you guys deciding to launch the first VC fund?
Yeah, you know, we had been involved with VCs, mostly raising money from them.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a short period of time at Charles River Ventures and my partner Vic was at RRE for a few years. And I think all four of us were interested in getting into venture, but we also weren't really interested in joining as an associate and working our way up the ladder. Venture capital tends to be pretty top heavy, unlike kind of other areas of finance. So we kind of wanted to do our own thing. I think we're all pretty entrepreneurial. So we made what probably was maybe a stupid decision at the time to try and raise our own fund and a tiny fund at that. We were all still kind of doing our own things as entrepreneurs at the time. So while it was a fund, we really looked a lot more like an angel group. We just had pooled our capital, but that allowed us to build a track record. And also it was kind of an MVP. Did we want to work together for better or worse? Venture funds last at least 10 years. So you better make sure you like the people you're working with.
And which fund was it where you started attracting institutional investors? And what was that like?
Yeah, sure. So our third fund is really our first institutional fund. Can't name all the LPs, but we had a major top five, top six university anchor that one. So the first one was our own money and some friends. The second one was high net worth and one family office. The third one mentioned anchored by a university and some other institutional investors. And then the fourth or fifth, we brought in a bunch of large pension funds, foundations, more university endowments, hospital systems, tried to optimize in the later years for folks that we think are, you know, adding value to the world versus just families.
And what's the thesis and overall strategy of the fund?
Yeah, so we're very focused from a stage perspective. We only invested seed. And what seed is kind of broad. We see seed as a spectrum of different types of rounds, starting with what a lot of people call pre-seed, very early small rounds, up to what people might call more of a mango seed or $4 or $5 million seed round. So we address all that. We focus on leading or co-leading all the rounds we invest in. We think that's really important in terms of adding value to entrepreneurs. As a founder, there's nothing kind of big waste of time when you're talking to lots of different VCs and they all say, okay, I'm in once you find a lead. That's not super helpful. So having gone through that ourselves, we really focus on leading. And then we tend to be relatively broad in terms of sectors. We invest across four major areas, SaaS, developer, hard tech, and consumer. The last, say, 3 or 4 years, we've been more B2B SaaS oriented. But that changes over time, depending on the theses that each of us are working on.
And why is that it's more B2B SaaS these days?
It's just where we've been seeing the last 4 or 5 years, the most exciting companies. You know, we just feel like there's a lot of opportunity, whether it's application layer SaaS infrastructure. I would kind of throw developer as part of that, B2B developer tools and frameworks. That's where we've been getting most excited. But if you look kind of the earlier years, it was pretty even between B2B and consumer. So it really depends on where we're finding the most interesting opportunities.
Right.
And your companies tend to have a more deep technical bent, right? Is that by design? Talk to us a little bit about your philosophy around picking companies. Do you look for a great idea in a big market? Are you really focused on the team, or how do you pick?
So I think first and foremost is the team. And I think you'll find that from most investors, especially when you're investing in the early stage that we are. A lot of these concepts and visions will change over time. The team, hopefully, especially the founding team, is what's consistent. So we're first and foremost around teams. And then to your point, we're all engineers, and I'd say more technical than the average VC. So we tend to gravitate towards teams that have strong technical underpinnings. So a lot of our founding teams are themselves technical. We probably invest in more technical CEOs or potentially CEOs that were former CTOs than most. It's not a requirement. And we certainly have teams that are more business oriented, but I'd say we lean towards more technical teams. And we often like to invest in companies that have some technical innovation, or at least they've done something at the beginning that's more difficult to build. Now, that's not a long-term lasting moat, but that early advantage and difficulty of quickly reproducing, we think is important. That said, these technical moats are usually short lasting. So we want them to have a vision for how they build kind of more permanent moats over time, whether that's just their go-to-market motion, whether that's a data moat, whether that's network effects. There's a lot of different ways to do that. And I think in general, network effects and data moats can be overemphasized. But that said, there certainly are opportunities to build them or utilize that as a partial moat.
Do you want to maybe pick one of your companies and tell us the story, maybe a company you are especially proud of?
Yeah, sure. I think I'll give you kind of a two for one. One of our companies we were fortunate to lead the seed around in our third fund is a company called Attentive, based in New York. Actually, the story goes way back to our first fund. We met Brian and AJ in the early days, and I say led, you know, it's a relatively small check, but we were the first investors in their seed round building a company called Tap Commerce. It was the first mobile retargeting platform, so allowed mobile apps to re-engage with users that had churned, something that at the time hadn't, you saw on the web, but hadn't existed for native apps. We're pretty successful. I raised a Series A about a year later, and then about 18 months after the seed were bought, I think it's reported $100 million by Twitter. Nice early outcome. We're hoping for companies to go big, but at the time made sense given the environment. And then one thing we're really proud of is, and we've had five or six of these cases where founders have some sort of success, we work with them, and then they come back to us. So after spending some time at Twitter, they started a new company, now Attentive. We were really fortunate to co-lead their seed round with the friends at NextView, who had also invested in Tap Commerce. And that's just been a real rocket ship. They raised a large round at multi-billion dollars recently, and I think just one of the most exciting companies anywhere right now.
And what does the company do?
They are a messaging platform for B2B brands, mainly starting with e-commerce, so allow businesses to interact with their users over messaging. One analogy I think is pretty interesting. If you look at how businesses in China interact with their customers, they generally do that over WeChat, and WeChat handles the whole infrastructure from a SaaS perspective, but also the messaging infrastructure. This is really that for the US or Western world. The messaging infrastructure is mainly SMS, or it could be other platforms, but they run the whole SaaS aspect in terms of targeting and maintenance of that messaging back and forth conversation.
Tell us about the funds, what you guys call the ABCs, and how that impacts not only team members that you bring on board, but also companies that you choose to invest in.
Yeah, sure. So we have certain aspects of our own brand and ethos that we think are important and track what, as founders of the firm, at the end of the day, we're founders just like the folks that we're investing in. We started ENIAC and we'll kind of continue to build out, and we think that's important. So things like authenticity, we think is extremely important. Things like being bold in terms of the decisions we're making and the folks that we invest in, being curious, just always wanting to learn more and being open to new information, and then scrappiness. We didn't just start with a $50 million fund. We started very small and worked our way up. And we think it's very important for us as a firm, as the folks that we're hiring. And by the way, we're hiring six people this year. and also the founders we invest in to have that kind of scrappiness.
Right. And tell us a little bit about, you guys have both a platform and a network that I'm sure it provides a ton of value, obviously, for your founders. Do you want to touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So if you think about how to build a VC fund, you can go with a, what I'd say, like a much more GP-centric approach, where the GPs or the folks, kind of partners of the firm, are doing the heavy lifting, or you can go with broader platform approach with some where you hire lots of people and they have specific backgrounds that can be helpful. Overall, we are more of the GP-centric approach. And what we've done for the platform is really try and add as much leverage as possible so that the GPs can add as much value. So we've built a large network of experts in the industries, folks we've worked with before. We've gone on filled holes. For example, hey, we don't have anyone in our network who's great at developer evangelism. Let's go find someone who's awesome at that. So I'd say in this grand scheme of things, we are more of GPs. We want to be the first and last conversation with founders. We don't want to outsource that to junior investment professionals or platform teams. But we have also brought in a bunch of folks who can add value on the core team, and we'll continue to do that, but also brought up this big network. And I should give a shout out to my partner, Nahal, who's probably has the best network of any person I know, let alone WVC. And a lot of our platform is really professionalizing the network he's already built and making it so that we all can access it on behalf of the companies we work with. So hat to him, he really built that out.
Right.
What's your take on the New York City venture ecosystem these days? I'd love to hear your thoughts and how that compares. And I know you have an office also in Silicon Valley, how the two compare.
Yeah, New York's clearly the second biggest market if you look at venture funding. And we think it's really underserved. One thing we've been tracking for the last few years is the supply-demand dynamics of every market. Mm-hmm. And the way we do that is demand is how many high-quality companies. And you can't look at exits because there's too much of a time lag. So we look at how many companies at least raise a Series B in a certain time frame per market. And then the supply is how many firms are leading seed rounds in each market, whether or not they're located there. And when we take the ratio of those two, New York's the best market in terms of that dynamic. So there's a scarcity of money, or it's underserved by the seed community. Actually, the Bay Area is the worst, and the other major markets are in between. So we're really bullish on New York. I think the competing factor to that is COVID and the world that we're in and what's going to happen over the next couple of years. I think geography is less important than it was. I think people are realizing they can do a lot of their job, whether it's VC or a founder, over Zoom. I still believe that in-person meetings are important, especially for really important decisions. Mm-hmm. So I think geography has become less important, and we're looking for companies anywhere. Our offices are New York and SF, so those are our centers of gravity. We also have companies all throughout North America. We have made a couple investments outside the US. I think we're open to it in the right situations. But I'd say, yeah, bullish on New York, but also kind of bullish on distributed teams, multi-location teams, and the fact that great founders can be anywhere.
There were distributed teams for a while now with many companies, right? But do you think that COVID has accelerated this trend? And do you think that there is a change of mindset on the investor side about investing in truly distributed teams?
Yeah, for sure. And I guess there's different flavors of it, right? There's the totally distributed team, which is everyone kind of works from wherever they are, and no, there's not really an office, and maybe they try and meet some period of time in the same place. Then you have kind of dual location teams, which you may also call distributed, which even before COVID, we had a bunch of them. Just even thinking before COVID, the two boards that I joined, one was San Francisco and Delhi, and the other one was New York and Berlin. Generally, the engineering team being outside the US and the business team being in a major US hub. So that we've seen for a while. And because of, you know, some of the constraints on immigration in the US, I think that's a model we're big fans of. What we're seeing more now, and certainly this has existed with companies like GitLab, are fully distributed teams that are operating really well. Mm-hmm. And those are the choices that founders have to make. There's pros and cons to either approach. That said, being able to hire great people anywhere, and they just need to be potentially in the same time zone, and you have access to strong internet, that's a big advantage. So I think you're going to see more and more of that.
Are there particular thesis that you're excited about currently? And can you give us an example on why you're excited about it?
Yeah. As a firm, we balance between opportunistic and thesis-oriented investments. We think at Seed that it's especially important to be opportunistic because great companies can kind of come out of anywhere. You know, if you're a Series B investor, it's a little easier to have a specific thesis and then map out the four companies in that space and then see if one of them is someone you want to work with. When you're a Seed investor and often the first money in, that you don't have that luxury. So about half of our investments are totally opportunistic. I was talking about Attentive before. When we invested in Attentive, we had no thesis around what they were doing. Marketing tech in general is even a place we're not spending time. So you can't get kind of, I think, too tied up in theses. That having been said, the three major areas where I've been spending time are more kind of very data, machine learning intensive SaaS businesses, often utilizing newer techniques around natural language understanding, could be computer vision, or just general understanding of large data sets. That's kind of one area. The second is developer tools, API businesses, developer frameworks. Big believer that there's going to continue to be a move towards a developer-centric world within Fortune 500, especially, which is still kind of nascent. And then the third one is what I call modernizing the healthcare stack. Healthcare is a gigantic industry that is still quite archaic from an IT and data perspective. The key is figuring out, you can't just apply how things work from an infrastructure and stack perspective to healthcare. You have to figure out why it is the way it is. And in some cases, they can apply modern infrastructure. And in some cases, there's a reason it shouldn't be that way, or maybe it needs to be augmented. So those are kind of the three relatively broad places where I'm spending my time purposely, but as always, have to be open to great founders that are doing stuff outside of that.
And has your thought process regarding any of those, particularly with healthcare, shifted because of COVID?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, all three have been affected by COVID. You know, to take one specific example, I think it's been, to your point about healthcare, it's been really interesting how things have shifted. You know, the percentage of people that are accessing telemedicine is obviously much higher. A lot of payers and providers have had to open to new ways of doing things, which I think is just given a lot more opportunity for disruption. So yeah, healthcare is one of those places. We were talking a little bit about my background. I don't have a healthcare background, so I only know enough to be dangerous. But now having been invested in these in companies that in the healthcare space the last few years, I've gotten a good enough feel for it. And you know, it's one of the good things about our model, which we co-lead a lot of rounds. We're able to, we try and be really collaborative. Our model is never to need to invest more than half the seed round. So in a case like healthcare, we can be kind of the company builders at the table and bring in some folks that are really deep in healthcare or even this particular sector of healthcare to kind of augment that.
Switching gears for a second, tell us a little bit about your background. You know, you obviously mentioned you're an engineer. Tell us where you grew up and what drew you into engineering and then from what took you from engineering to the business side.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in downtown Boston. As a kid, I always really loved math and science. I was just really bad at language-oriented stuff, so maybe that's why I love math and science so much. And when it was time to go to college, engineering seemed right for me. I mean, my favorite high school class ever was physics, so I basically looked at what major looked most like physics, and that was mechanical engineering, so that was my major. As I mentioned earlier, went to Penn, and that's where I met Nihal, Tim, and Vic. I'd say about 2 years into that, I realized I was actually more interested in computer science, but it was a little late to switch majors without adding another year, which definitely would have been costly. So I stayed with mechanical engineering, but after school became a developer, both self-taught and took some computer science classes. So my first 2 years out of school was developer, mainly for a SaaS software company called Pega that's still doing pretty well these days, and then became an engineering team manager. So managing 10 to 12 groups of engineers, still coding myself, but also kind of overseeing that. Went back to school at Wharton. I enjoyed being a developer and managing engineering, but I also had a longer term vision of marrying that with more business. So that's where I went to Wharton. Mm-hmm. Spent some really short stints at Microsoft and Samsung in product management and strategy and hated it. Just the big company thing came very clear. It wasn't for me. These were less than a year total between the two of them. And then I was actually working in Korea for Samsung and corporate strategy, moved back to Boston where I was from, kind of to figure out what I was going to do next. And I was really fortunate to link up with a guy named Izar Armini at Charles River Ventures up in Boston. I had a thesis at the time that I built when I was in Korea that mobile would be the next computing platform. They had 4G networks there. They had pretty powerful, quote unquote, dumb phones. And I just saw how people were using their phones. And then the iPhone got announced and it kind of all seemed to fit together. So I told Ezra about this thesis and he's like, I want you to help out with some stuff. They were looking at some stuff in wireless power transfer and my focus had been electromechanical engineering. So I was able to help them with that. And they made a seed investment, a company called Vlingo that was two folks out of MIT who had figured out a new way to do voice recognition and ended up jumping on there. And we built out Vlingo for the next 4 years, which is the first voice assistant. And we were acquired by our biggest competitor, and that's now being used in Siri. So that was an awesome experience. Got to kind of go from just a couple of folks to over 100 employees. And I drove fundraising. So we raised about, I think we raised $57 million and got to see bad behavior on the side of a lot of VCs on Sand Hill Road. And I think that impacted how I work with founders.
Sure.
And then after we were acquired, I joined another venture-backed business in New York called Thumb as a chief business officer at General Catalyst and DFJ and SoftBank had invested. And we got acquired about 18 months later. So that was a lead up to starting ANIAC, I guess, full circle from your first question.
And what do you think are the most important characteristics of being a VC and the flip side of the coin? What are the most important characteristics to being a really good founder? And I'm sure your background and everything that you've accomplished is certainly, I'm sure, funneled into your thought process there.
Yeah. On the VC side, I would say the most underrated characteristic is probably empathy. I think a lot of VCs lack the proper empathy to understand how difficult it is to be a founder.
Right.
And having been on that side of the table and my partners all being founders and operators, I think that we're better than most on that. You know, at the end of the day, it comes down, the rubber meets the road as a VC on decision making. And that's something that is kind of hard to characterize as one thing, but which companies you invest in. Mm-hmm. But that's obvious, I guess. The empathy, I think, is more underserved. And then as a founder, I mean, there's just so many things and it's really hard to characterize.
What do you look for?
Yeah, it's a kind of big founder market fit at the end of the day, like founders who's based on their backgrounds and interests and passion, it's just obvious why they needed to build that business.
Right.
I think the opposite of that is the founder that was at HBS and did a bunch of research and like found a problem they want to solve. I'm sure there's examples of that working, but
there's worse examples than that. Yeah. There's a lawyer and an accountant that.
Counting them as part of the addressable market. No. I think we tend to index relatively heavily on founder market fit. And for what it's worth, I think having been doing this, you know, over 10 years, we try our best to learn and take index the right lessons and be careful not to index the wrong ones, because it is really difficult as an early stage founder. You can make a bad decision and have a great outcome. And then I think over index on that. But I think that founder market fit's probably the most important.
Yeah, definitely. So at this part, we're going to go ahead and flip to our standard question segment. And this is just four standard questions that we ask all of our guests in an attempt to get to know you better. And we're looking forward to hearing your answers. So the first question is our NVCA question. The National Venture Capital Association advocates for public policy that supports the venture community and the American entrepreneurial ecosystem. If there is one thing that you could change about the VC industry or one policy you'd advocate for, what would it be?
I don't think this can necessarily be solved with policy, but I think the biggest need in the venture capital industry is just matching. The power of VC, I think, is pretty incredible in ability to create wealth and employment. And I think it's very important for the U.S. as a country and for other countries to put effort towards it. If you look at the folks that are creating these businesses, it doesn't necessarily match the country as a whole. There are a lot of underrepresented groups that aren't being properly invested in. And personally, I think African Americans is the group that needs the most attention in terms of more money going to great African American founders. And that's a really hard problem, and it's going to take a lot of effort. You know, I think my partners and I have continued to put a lot of effort into solving that problem, but it's going to be a long, long haul, and it's going to take a lot of people within the community, and it can't just be solved with policy. But I think it's an important problem to be solved.
Yep, absolutely. And the second question is, if you weren't a VC and money wasn't a concern, what career would you have?
I think it'd be like a DJ / music producer. I've always enjoyed, even when before it was, I guess, cool, DJing. And my partner, Nahal, and I used to play at bars and clubs and stuff, not very well. And I still like messing around with my computer, trying to create mixes and mostly electronic music. So I don't think I have enough talent to make money, but if money were not a factor, I'd probably do that.
And then third, who is someone that you look up to and why?
My little brother, Travis, who has Down syndrome, has really been a hero to me and someone I look up to because just amazing to me and really inspiring to see how much effort he puts into making the most of his abilities mm-hmm. and his ability to just really enjoy life and savor the moment. It's something I would love to do more. And I think if everyone was had the ability to enjoy life and enjoy these little things, we'd all be happier. So I'd say him.
Yeah, no, that's great. And very, very true. And fourthly, what's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
I received this from a bunch of people and it's nothing that novel, but just following your passions in general. As a guy who raised a $1.6 million fund with his buddies from school, like that's never going to be like the logical choice that anyone would recommend. But I think feel very fortunate to be doing what I do with the folks I'm doing it with. And that was based on just more of a gut passion or what I wanted to do with life. So I think just in general, following your passions, taking risks, been fortunate to get that at the right time from a bunch of different folks and glad that I followed it.
Yeah, for sure. It's great advice.
Hadley, thank you very much for your time today. We really appreciated getting to know you better and getting to know more about ENIAC.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate the time.
And follow us on Twitter at ProofVC or on our website at proof.vc.